You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Andrew Hammond, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations from authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes and whatever platform you might be listening from. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
Yes, you guys are good to go.
So you're in DC?
In DC just now, yeah.
But I'm on the East Coast too, I'm in New York.
You're in the Lower East Side, yeah?
Yeah, I came back home just before, I was in LA for a year and I came back home just before everything locked down.
I lived in New York between 2015 and 2017. I really loved the city, and over in the Lower East Side, I really loved Kossar's, Bialy's.
I live very close there. That's so funny. Yeah, it's like nothing over here. No one really knows like this because I'm pretty far east. You know.
Yeah.
Don't really. They think more closer to Orchard Street, but I'm actually really close to Kossar's, and it's really it's good. Okay, so. My book, American Spy, is set mostly in the 1980s. The main character is Marie Mitchell, who is a Black woman and an FBI agent. And she is asked, she's approached by the CIA and asked to help undermine Thomas Sankara's Marxist government. Sankara was a real life leader. He was really the leader of Burkina Faso in West Africa in the 1980s, and you know, the request kind of forces Marie to figure out what it is that she really believes in, if she's really willing to undermine this person who she feels very complicated feelings for, romantic feelings, and also you know, feeling that he is a important and popular leader. And so, yeah, that's my short synopsis. I could go on, but I won't.
And this is one of the few novels or even books that I have read that looks at the political landscape of Burkina Faso. Could you just, for anybody that is new to this, which is probably a lot of listeners, could you just sketch that out for us? Sankara is a fascinating figure, isn't he? He was called the African Che Guevara.
Mm-hmm, he was, and he has a lot of similarities, and that was one of the reasons why I was attracted to telling the story, because he is so much like Che, and people know Che here, but they don't really know Sankara. The similarities include his charisma, and he, you know, he drove around the capital city of Burkina on a motorcycle. He played the guitar. He was a young K charismatic leader. And he was leader of Burkina Faso in the mid-1980s. And during that time, it was a kind of a golden era for the nation. But I don't want to give too much more about what happens to him, because that might spoil some elements of the plot if you've never heard of him before. But yeah, that's kind of who he is. The African Che is a good comparison.
And he's only 33 when he comes to power in the early 80s, and then he's this just really fascinating figure. And he also, the country Burkina Faso as we know it, that's really a modern name for it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, its colonial name was Upper Volta. It was a French colony up until the 60s. So Sankara himself, you know, remembered that. He had the experience of living under colonial rule. So because it was a relatively new country when he was the leader, he also ended up writing the national anthem. You know, like, it really was, he was a very pivotal figure and is still thought of as one to this day in the country.
Well, I really loved your novel, and not just because it's a spy novel. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more. I think our readers will be really interested to know how you landed on the spy fiction genre. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself as a spy fiction writer? Who are some of your favorite spy fiction authors? Just tell us a little bit more about your engagement with the spy fiction genre.
Of course, yes. So I don't see myself as a spy fiction writer. This book started for me as an assignment in grad school. I was supposed to write a story that was based in suburbia. That was just the background. It was a suburban story. And I saw this suburban mom, a Black woman, who was someone that makes an attempt on her life. And the most interesting story, you know, for me, was that it was because of something, some political intrigue. And so every question I had about her backstory, it just, the answer in my heart was that she was a spy. And I got really excited by that. But then it meant I had to play a bunch of catch up because I wasn't really that familiar with the genre. And I felt like, you know, if you're going to write in a genre, you better respect it. So you better read as much as you can of the classics and of what's going on now. So I started with Le Carré, and I read Spy Who Came In From the Cold. And I loved that book for a lot of reasons. And I borrowed elements of it, you know, the cynicism. I feel that Marie has different reasons to be cynical because she's a Black woman in an institution that maybe doesn't serve her. But she does have that sort of same cynicism. And I read The Quiet American, which I thought was great too. I didn't realize that the title is a little bit of a burn on Americans, but the only quiet American is a dead American. I thought that was really funny. Yeah, you know, I read Rogue Male. And then I read Restless by William Boyd. It was, you know, I'm not gonna go through all of them, but I did read a lot of spy novels, and then a couple of memoirs from intelligence officers, most notably one from a female officer called Blowing My Cover. And her life, you know, she was writing about much later in time, but than Marie's life, but I felt that some of the same dynamics would probably have been felt.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Graham Greene and John le Carré, because the novel deals with the moral ambiguity that you see in those novels rather than the certitude that you see in Tom Clancy or something where it's more there's right and there's wrong. Was that something that attracted you to it, that opportunity to play around with that.
I love that. I love those. Yes, it was something that attracted me to it. I think that that's what's the most interesting thing in a spy novel. To me, though, it's not the, it's thinking about. Yeah, I think there's a lot of room to be a complicated spy, and a lot of that complication is in the moral ambiguity of sort of, does it sit well with you to do what you've been asked to do? I just personally don't have the experience of having unconsidered patriotism in my life. I feel that, as a Black American, that is a little bit of a more difficult ask for me. That's the thing that I wanted to, that I was most interested in trying to uncover in telling Marie's story.
And you draw out some really interesting parallels in the book between espionage and intelligence and the African American experience. So for example, when Marie graduates, her father says to her, I've been, if I remember correctly, I've been undercover in this country for my whole life. Could you speak a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, of course. That's like a direct reference to Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. On his deathbed, the main character's grandfather on his deathbed says something very similar, that he's been a spy in the enemy's country. And it's like a confounding thing for the main character. He doesn't understand what his grandfather meant, because as far as he's aware, his grandfather has been very obsequious for his whole life. And, to think that there was some sort of betrayal in that is, he can't really process it. And it's a question that he comes back to for the whole of the book. And so in some ways, my book is an answer to that question, what it means to kind of keep that double consciousness of just sort of being hyper aware of how you're perceived as a Black American and how you perceive yourself and how those two things are in conflict. I felt like being a spy novel was a really good metaphor for that. That's what attracted me to the story, because I feel that the real spy or the most honest spy is a person who's always is hyper aware of how they are perceived, because their life is in danger if they make any missteps around that. That was really, it was definitely Ralph Ellison that motivated that. And then the idea of how, what I understand spies to be, that kept that theme going in the story.
One of the other things that I found really fascinating was that there's a number of different levels that the novel is working on. So it's part of the spy fiction genre, but there's also a gender dynamic to the novel. There's the politics of race in the novel. So there's lots of interesting layers there. Could you help us unpack those intersecting layers a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel that I was bringing my vision of the world to a genre that maybe isn't that familiar with my vision of the world, which is, there are tons of writers and more women writing in the spy genre, but I really felt like my interpretation of what a spy is so different and then Tom Clancy's, for example, like just how that person must move through the world. I just have this assumption of a lot of anxiety in that position and a lot of an incredible amount of self-awareness and an incredible, real nuanced perception of your own identity. And so for Marie, that those two things are intertwined. She's really, in her personal life, she's very aware of her own identity as a woman and as a Black woman. And then, when she's undercover, her sense of herself, just her awareness of herself is really brought to the fore, because she's performing a version of herself as an undercover officer.
One of the parts of the book that I really love is when Marie goes to Burkina Faso and she's dealing with or she's working through questions of identity. So one of the passages that I really love, she says, "Every day I spent in Burkina Faso was a reminder of how American I was. In the United States, I thought of myself I thought of myself as black before I thought of myself as American. And Ouagadougou, routinely, those designations were reversed."
Yeah, I mean, that was just what really happened to me when I went to Ouaga. You know, I spent 6 weeks there, which is about the same amount of time in my head that I imagine Marie spent there, just because I wanted, you know, whatever I was going to write about the country to be as authentic as possible, because it's not my culture. You know, I am really an American. And so what surprised me was how aware of my Americanness I felt, because people would, you know, stop me in the street. They could tell just from looking at me that I didn't belong. And, you know, that's always a disorienting feeling. But it was also really important to that experience, and really honest to my feelings at the time.
And I like the way that she has a motorcycle helmet, and she's just relieved that gives her some respite from being recognized as an American quite so much.
yeah, and that, you know, I had a red one with someone kind of scared it up for me, and I would, the visor was actually kind of dirty, so I couldn't see through it, so I kept it up. It was like a lot of dust kind of trapped on it, but yeah, it was really hot to have my head in that thing the whole time, so there was a trade-off, but yeah.
In research for our interview, I came across a number of commentators that were, you know, commenting on the fact that a female African-American intelligence officer is very atypical of the genre. Why do you think that you have been a trailblazer in many ways for the genre? Why is there so little work that has been done?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, that, you know, it feels like, I'm not sure. You know, I know that maybe there's a closed feeling to the genre. Maybe people kind of, writers assume, okay, you know, my voice is not going to be one that's going to find any interest or, you know, in the genre. But I didn't really have that concern. I think I have a lot of faith in readers. I think that there are a lot of readers who are excited by the possibility of reading, you know, an experience that's different from their own. And if it's in a genre that is, you know, a genre they love, then all the better. And then I think, you know, most of the authors traditionally have been white men, but some of them have tried. Like, I remember, I think there's another Graham Greene story where, you know, there's like a mild-mannered MI6 officer, and he's got a South African wife, and there's a whole, I think it's something with blood in the title. And there's a whole, you know, communist subplot. And I felt, when I read the description, I was like, oh, is this the same terrain as my book? And then I read it and I was like, oh no, not at all. I don't have to worry. So I'm not sure. I feel, you know, I'm not sure that I'm answering the question very well. It's just because I don't know. You know, I hope though that, you know, and I certainly didn't think, okay, well, I'm gonna trailblaze, you know, like I was just sort of focused on the metaphor. The interesting thing to me about feeling like you're always hiding in plain sight, and what that is, what that would be, because I feel that Marie felt that way, feels that way, and what it would be to make that feeling literal, you know, as a part of her job. So yeah, my interest was in kind of telling the story, and then once I realized it was in this genre, then doing the work of making sure that I was informed enough about the genre to treat it with respect. But yeah, I hope that it means that other people will tell, you know, different stories in the genre too. I think, you know, every genre I think needs a little bit of blast of fresh air. So yeah, I hope that more people come after me.
And John Le Carré said, "I use the furniture of espionage to amuse the reader." Do you see yourself as using the furniture of espionage to do something in particular, other than finish a writing assignment and write your first novel?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the same way to amuse the reader, you know, the first chapter is pretty action-packed on purpose, because I think, you know, I know how I go to things. I read the first couple of pages on Amazon, and if it's boring, then I don't buy it. I want it to be able to, you know, assume other people do that and want them to read. So, you know, and I think that the genre is, people are like interested because of it. But yeah, you know, I do think that I will stay with my next book. I'd like to stay using genre elements, but I think the next thing I want to write is about a superhero. So, because she does, I think that's that I am interested in heroes. You know, Marie is a kind of hero. And I think that I keep, think at the heart of what I keep doing is going back to our idea of, like an American idea of heroism. And because I guess that's my thematic interest.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast, so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
Could you talk a little bit more about how you came across Burkina Faso in particular, as opposed to Senegal or some other country? And also speak a little bit more about New York. I know that that's where you live. Help us understand how you populated the book.
Sure, yeah. Actually, it was another kind of backfilling. Like, I didn't choose Burkina, I chose Sankara. You know, I think I'd first read about him in college and found had a historical crush, that he was cute. I thought, you know, he was a really compelling historical figure, and I was surprised that, you know, it had taken me so late in my life to learn who he was. So you know, I kind of always had in the back of my head that I wanted to write something about him. And then, you know, once I realized that, then I realized, oh, okay, I need to go to Burkina. I need to really try to get a sense of the context in which this person was leading. So that was the Burkina element. And then the Martinique element is kind of, if you think about it, so it's like New York, Burkina, which is on the, you know, western coast, on the coast or close to the coast of West Africa, landlocked, but, and then Martinique. So there's like a triangle across the Atlantic. And to me, that triangle represents like the roots of the slave trade. You know, like my family was, I'm from Barbados, and you know, I live here now, so I feel like I have that triangle in my family as well. So, and I chose Martinique because it's geographically close to Barbados, but it's also Francophone, and I needed her because of Sankara to, you know, it's a French-speaking country. I needed her to be a Francophone. So, yeah, and then New York is because New York's my city forever. You know, I've been spending time in LA because I've been writing for television, and I'm here now. And I missed it. You know, growing up, I always thought that every city was just a version of New York, but bigger or smaller. That is so wrong. I don't know where I got that from. That is so wrong. You know, LA is nothing like it. It's, you know, you need, I couldn't understand why people said they needed a car in a place like LA. And now I get it. I am a big, big New York fan. And, you know, my family is from here too. My grandfather, you know, in this story, in the novel, the main character's father is a deputy police commissioner of New York. My grandfather really was. So, you know, we've been, my family has lived here since the 30s. So.
What was the connection to Harlem? Because Harlem features quite prominently in the book. Is that because you used to live there, or was that because it was an epicenter of African-American culture and identity, or is that a little bit of both?
Yeah, it was because I think of it as an epicenter. And, you know, it is, I do love, I feel that this book, even though it is a spy novel, is in conversation with a lot of Harlem Renaissance literature. So I kind of was paying an homage to that, to this place that has created so many writers that I admired and that were in my mind as I was writing. And then also, you know, my grandfather, you know, lived in Harlem. I've never lived in Harlem, but I certainly pretended to. I had a lot of friends who lived on 135th Street when I was 14, who didn't know exactly where I lived, because I was a little embarrassed about living, you know, downtown. But I spent a lot of time there, and enough time where I could see that I felt that I could accurately give, like, there are places that I wrote about that no longer exist. They've been, you know, mowed down and made into like Target or Starbucks, but I remember them from when I was a teenager, and I felt like those places were, you know, those were the places that Marie would have been around in the 80s, not the whatever's on 125th Street now. It was authenticity and also paying homage to a group of writers.
And another thing that fascinated me was the title American Spy, and it made me think of, it set off all kinds of synapses in my brain, and I was thinking about all the other novels or movies with American in the title, American Psycho, American Gangster, you know, American Gothic. Did you feel consciously that you were writing in a kind of American fill in the blank genre?
Yeah, that was like the one thing that I was always aware, like knew that I wanted to do. I knew that I wanted there to be American in the title, and it changed over the course of it. So the first title was L'American. It was like L, like capital, like a half in French, half English word. And I nixed it because I hated saying it. Because it's just about, even now saying it, I feel weird. It looked good on the page, but I hated saying it. So I was actually, there was no worry. I didn't have to do any, no one, there was no pressure on me to come up with a new title. Everyone knew I hated it, but there was no pressure. And then I went away to Mongolia. And I was kind of in the middle of nowhere. And I was standing really, really close to this elementary school, which was the only place where I could get Wi-Fi. And on my phone, I got an email from my editor that said, you have to decide right now what this title is going to be. So I've been messing around for years. And then all of a sudden, when it was like an inopportune time, I had to like kind of figure out what I wanted it to be. And it was an important thing to me. And my agent and my editor, everyone was like, okay, you know, we like American Woman. And I even now hear the Lenny Kravitz song. So I was like, I cannot have that. That'll be what everyone thinks of forever. It just is not going to work for me. So I, you know, there was a long list and I thought, okay, American Spy is good for me because it's a very generic title, but the character is really specific. And so I think like that's an okay, I was happy with that balance with saying, you know, maybe you have a generic idea of what this person is, but the character is actually going to be the opposite of that. And I think that there's a lot of literature and stuff I've noticed now from like Black creators who are using American, like I'm thinking of Chiari Jones as an American Marriage, for example. Like there are a couple where it's like, this is a Black story and we're putting it into the like general rubric of American because we are Americans as well. And it should go without saying, but you know, think of us when you think of American. So, I mean, I feel like that was where I was going with that. And now I think I want to keep doing it. I wrote a script about a Black woman who's a con artist and I called it American Confidence. So I think I have maybe three of them in me before you can do a trio and then before everyone gets bored of the same thing. So I'm going to make them count, but I think I got two more left with the American in the title.
An American trilogy.
Yeah, the American trilogy.
And so you mentioned like doing research by reading spy fiction. Did you do research on what it takes to be a spy, the spy mm-hmm. craft, the trade craft? Tell us a little bit more about that process.
Yeah, I mean, for the spy, how to be a spy, it was just a lot of books and a lot of, you know, a lot of podcasts, a lot of people who were like, this, I've actually had this experience. And then for Sankara-related research, I feel like there were three big areas of research. For Sankara-related research, you know, I was going to the country, and actually I got so lucky, it's a very informal place, and I was able to meet someone who had run for president a few years before I met him, who was actually in a book about Sankara that I had taken out of the library. It was a picture of him in the 80s, and he had been close friends and was actually chased out of the country during the coup that, you know, took Sankara out of power. There was an attempt on this guy's life, and I got to do like the primary, you know, I got to do an interview with him. He showed me his like poetry that he'd written in exile, and it was really, and he talked about his friends and missing him, and so that was really good. And then the FBI stuff, it was back to books, you know, reading about, you know, Ronald Kessler has a book just called FBI, and I was like, this is it. This is a book that I feel like, yeah, this is something I can read. This will help me explain the FBI. And so just all as much material as I can get, as much firsthand accounts as I could get. and then guessing, you know, about how what I imagine it would, just using my imagination once I had all of that information in front of me.
And talking about the FBI, one of the passages that really struck me was a sense of self-importance permeated the culture. So did machismo and knee-jerk conservatism. To get by, I told my colleagues that I didn't care about politics. Very few of those men understood having no choice about whether they were political or not. Unlike me, they weren't people who had had their existence politicized on their behalf.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of felt like that probably was what it feels like. You know, like, because I mean, you know, the Kessler book that I described, you know, I think I actually got that from reading it, because the book is published in the 90s, early 90s, and that was why I started there, because, you know, I felt like it was pretty close to when Marie would have been there. And I felt like that book was really instructive in what it was not saying, as much as what it did say. Like, and who, you know, there are chapters about ethics and about race and about women, but the way that it's presented, like, you know, like in the book, Kessler goes out of his way to be like, this is a very attractive woman. You know, it's like that has no bearing on her abilities as an FBI agent, but that's like the first descriptor, the first adjective in his sentence about her. And it just felt like, to me, that was emblematic of, I'm sure, what it felt like to work in one of these institutions. Like, so, and then just my own experience with sometimes being in, you know, where I feel that I'm just feeling a little bit on the outside in an institution, just in work places, you know, I felt just like whatever I felt must really be amplified in the FBI, because, you know, there was a lot of, you know, at the time, like it wasn't even considered sexism, because it was just unconsidered, you know, like you can just say, I don't want, you know, I think this woman's going to get in my way. And it's also, and I don't think it would really be that big of a deal. There's also kind of a thing, a comment on, you know, I think when I was rewriting that part of the book, I was also reading Casino Royale by Ian Fleming. And that is, I think people who are only familiar with the movies would be shocked by like what Bond's opinions are of women. Like, because he's like, no, I have to work with a woman. Oh no, this is a nightmare. And it's like deeply, deeply sexist. But you know, I thought it was, I mean, you know, I thought it was just worth mentioning that is kind of built into the history of some of this of the genre, and also of you know, these institutions. I feel very aware.
And have you ever had anyone from the FBI or the CIA reach out to you, or you know, did you ever speak to any spies? Has anyone ever said, yeah, I really like this, or you done that wrong? Or
no one from the FBI or CIA has been critical. They've been, I actually, a black woman who worked in the FBI, she at the time tweeted at me or sent me an email where she was like, oh, you know, I was really surprised by this book, that she got this, the feeling of it so right. And that was really flattering to me. And but I thought you were gonna say, was I ever like approached as a recruit? My mom was she was a social psychology student at the University of Michigan in the 80s, and I think that they wanted someone like that with that background for maybe an analyst position. So she got an interview, and she was in DC, and she had like a address book, and she is convinced that this address book just it disappeared, and she doesn't know what happened to it. She thinks that the CIA took it, I guess, and I think that she just misplaced it. But the fact that she was so paranoid about it makes me think it is really good that she did not move further with this application process, because, like, I think that, you know, it just felt so clear to me that she doesn't have the temperament for that kind of job when she's like, oh God, are they watching me? You know, so I thought that was really funny. She also told me that story, like, kind of late. I think I was like, it took me 7 years to write this book, and I think she told me that on year five. And I was like, what? this is relevant. Why didn't this come up before?
Year five. And on that topic, tell us a little bit more about the mechanics of writing the book. So you said it took 7 years. Was there, you know, and there's probably some listeners that would really love to write their first novel. Is there any advice that you could give them?
I mean, my first bit of advice would be read whatever you are want to write. You need to be reading. You need to be reading that specific genre. So, yes, I was reading a lot and researching a lot as I was writing. So I think, yes, first place to start is to read, and not even just reading, just like regular, like beach reading, but reading to deconstruct. You have to, when you have a feeling when something makes you think something or feel something, you should be trying to retrofit the scene and figure out what it is that the author did to make you have that feeling, if you want to try to recreate it for your readers. So, and then after that, write. You know, like, I just mean, you know, a lot of people want to write, they say they want to write, and then you kind of ask them, how much have you written? When do you write? You know, what writing have you done? And then you kind of start to see that it's more of a, that they've been writing in their head, but not actually putting anything down on the page. And you gotta put, you know, there's some fear there sometimes. You gotta start it down on the page, or you're not gonna get anywhere with it. I think it's probably better not to wait for inspiration to strike. And by probably, I mean, it is 100% better not to wait for inspiration to strike, but to just get up every day and say, I'm going to sit in front of my laptop and I'm going to write for an hour. And even if it's nothing comes out, the fact that you've done that, you're training yourself to keep doing it, because writing really is a marathon, you know, so you have to kind of get out onto the track, and you have to do at least a lap every day. That's the only way you're going to get any better at it. And then, you know, and that's the thing that keeps you going through. It's not waiting for the muse. The muse, you know, I don't know her. She doesn't hang out at my house. It's more muscle memory that gets you through the hard parts. When you're like, I don't know what to do. It's the fact that you have trained yourself to get up every day and sit down for the last 6 months that makes you do it the next day. And that's how a novel gets written. There's nothing else, really.
And do you have a, like, daily word limit that you try to reach, or do you have a certain time when you write, or what's your kind of method? Or
yeah, I think it's very important to know the time of day that you write best, because writing is hard enough without working against yourself. I write really early in the morning. It's very annoying to my fiance. I like to get up at 4 a.m. To write because there's, you know, it's just no one else around, and I'm not distracted by whatever's going on Twitter or in the news. I just can kind of have a little time, and then, you know, my day progresses and I do other types of work. And other types of writing that, you know, it's not my own projects, but you know, work. So yeah,
I know that you've done an MFA at Columbia. Could you tell us a little bit more about things that you've done in the past and the role that the MFA played in the novel coming to light? I don't know, how do you see the MFA fitting into the the novel and your backstory fitting into the novel?
MFA is, you know, one of those tricky things. I say it's part of my bio that I went there, but they don't. I mean, I'm a proud MFA holder and MFA graduate, but I think it's too expensive. I don't think anyone should pay $50,000 a year to learn how to write a novel, because you will not get that money back, and compound interest on your student loans will make you feel like you are drowning. I am speaking, I think it should be clear, from personal experience. So, like, you know, and so Columbia is not, I can't lie to people. I'm not going to say that they should definitely pursue an MFA. Not if it means taking on an incredible amount of debt. That said, if I had not gone to Columbia, I don't think that I would have had this novel published, because of the person who gave me that assignment, right? That to write the story that eventually became the novel, that was at Columbia. And he also he was my teacher, but he published that story, and he published it in a literary journal that my agent then read. So I never had to do like the submitting to slush piles or any of that because of my MFA. There's no guarantees, right? So you can't, I just think it's a lot to ask people to spend so much in tuition if there's no promise that they're going to have that kind of thing happen for them. And for the most part, people don't.
A few questions just to wrap up. Do you have a favorite spy fiction novel and a favorite spy movie?
I actually really loved The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. I know I mentioned it already, but it is, I love
it's
that.
It's wonderful,
movie.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, a favorite spy movie. I have a lot. I really like Atomic Blonde. I said that too in another interview, okay. And someone, the interviewer, rolled their eyes. But like, it was a lot of fun, and I'm like a big fan of Charlize Theron. So yeah, I think those two. And then, you know, in terms of spy TV shows, I also really like, there's the one that Deutschland 83 was the first, but it's like a series. That one is really cool. Now I've gotten into it. I'm steeped in the spy stuff.
It's been great to speak to you, Lauren. Is there anything that you think that is important to tell about your novel or about yourself that we haven't touched on?
You know, I mean, the only thing is like people. Often, so the book was on Obama's summer reading list, and that really was like took the course of my career and the book sales in just a really radically exciting direction. And so people kind of often ask me, like, did you know that was going to be on there, and what was that like? And I did not know. So my landlord told me, she sent me a text message about it while I was at work, and I had to pretend that I was paying attention to my boss when I obviously wasn't, because I just heard this incredible piece of news. And then I think, and I told someone else this recently, which is immediately after, it was on the list, my mom started harassing me about sending Barack Obama a thank you letter, because she's like, you know, I did not raise someone who is so rude as to not thank someone for doing something so important to them. And for like, we went back and forth on this for months. I was just like, I don't have his, what is he, Obama at Gmail? I don't have a direct contact. And we'll have to send in a letter to his website. And I'm sure that it's one of thousands that he receives. No one is ever gonna see it. But she wouldn't get off my ass about it. So finally, I just like, you know, like a year later, I sat down and I was like, "Dear President Obama, thank you for including me on your list." And you know, I am incredibly grateful. But you know, if he hears this, the thank you letter was not delayed because of, you know, because I'm not, because of a lack of gratitude. So, yeah.
And do you know if he got it?
Of course not. Like, it was just, I've never heard anything from it. I cannot imagine like that. It's just
Obama, if you're listening to this podcast,
Obama, yes.
Please thank write back to him. And thank you. That's one thing that I was thinking of. I mean, what does that feel like? There must be so many novelists or would-be novelists out there who would just, you know, that would be the dream for them, like a Washington Post bestseller, a New York Times book review, 100 recommended books for 2019 on Obama's summer reading list. I mean, what's that like to go from having not written your first novel to all of a sudden everyone, including me, is making a big fuss about you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think when you really, or when I really, really, really want something, I just never think about it because I don't want to be disappointed. You know, and I never really let myself think that that kind of thing could happen. I just was like, you know, I just kind of focused on finishing the book while I was writing it because it felt like going anywhere else was going to get in the way and kind of lead me to disappointment. But now it's just like, I just feel gratitude, you know, because it just feels like there are so many talented writers and there are so many, you know, that deserve a lot of recognition. And I just feel really lucky, you know, to have had this unexpected recognition. And it was just like such an exciting thing in my life. And it's such an exciting way to have my first book received. I'm still not in a rush to write a second because they are really hard, but it would have been that much harder, I think, if it had been published and you know, sold 5 copies. You know, because it just feels like it's just hard, you know, it's just such a hard process. As I said, it took me a long time, and you know, so to have that wind in my sails from president was like beyond my beyond even what my wildest dreams. So I just, yeah, I feel so grateful to whatever had, you know, whatever elements in the world allowed that to transpire, whatever people, you know, suggested the book or just or whatever. I nothing but just excitement and gratitude about it.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm personally, you know, gratified and pleased that you wrote the book, and it's a great addition to the literature. And it's available in our online bookstore. So please, you know, go out and get yourself a copy. It's a great book, and hopefully we'll see you in the espionage spy fiction genre after the American trilogy or something. But
thank you very much for having me. This was a great conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 non-profit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and would like to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.